Ken Auletta is joining me now. He has a book called Googled, The End of the World as We Know It. Ken has been writing about the media and related businesses for a long time for The New Yorker, and I'm happy to welcome him to Cairo FM. Good morning, Ken.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Before we start talking about some of the topics you cover in the book, let's talk about a present-day story about Google. Just this morning, we're hearing about Rupert Murdoch perhaps teaming up with Microsoft to block Google from linking to some of his news sites. Murdoch has said that he wants to try to make money from his online news ventures, and that perhaps blocking Google from linking to them would help him in that effort. What do you know about this?
Well, it's something that Murdoch's talked about. Actually, the idea was first proposed online by Jason Calacanis in a group discussion he was having about 10 days ago, which tells you how viral the Internet can be. But Murdoch, like a lot of newspaper owners and others, book publishers and television, et cetera, are frustrated that their content is not being paid for. And some of them are delusional. They believe that somehow the Internet or companies like Google or Microsoft is going to make them whole again. That won't happen. But Murdoch has a very interesting idea here, which is he's saying, I'm not going to let Google search any of my newspapers. I'm just going to give it exclusively to Microsoft's Bing search engine. And if Microsoft is willing to pay enough money, they can have it exclusively. It's a risky move, A, because the paper that Microsoft would want access to is the Wall Street Journal that Murdoch owns. His other papers are not as enticing to a company like Microsoft. And will Microsoft be willing to pay enough money to make it worthwhile to Mr. Murdoch? And how many other papers would be lined up to want a similar kind of a deal, and would they be willing to do it? The answer to the latter is no.
And what about the readers? Do you think that readers who are used to getting their news for free are going to effectively pay for that horse that's already out of the barn?
This is really a basic question here. One of the things I found in reporting my book is that there was a shift in Silicon Valley. A lot of Internet people were coming around to the view, and this was a jolt brought about by the recession, that advertising, to depend on advertising alone for your revenue was a mistake, because advertising was declining. And ultimately, you were copying the model practiced by free television and free radio of having one single source of revenue, and you needed more. But to do that, to have that second source of revenue, be it a subscription model or a micropayment model, you have to change the culture of the Internet. And the culture of the Internet is that information is free. And are people willing to pay for it? That's a big question we don't know the answer to.
Ken, I really enjoyed reading the book, and particularly the times when you refer to Google as a media company, or rather, I guess they refer to themselves as a media company, not an Internet company. And as I mentioned, you've been covering media-related issues for a long, long time. Have you ever heard of a company calling itself a media company without creating content?
Well, you see, there's where you get to an interesting discussion about what is content. I mean, you can make an argument that content is anything that captures your attention. And that is to say, you can make an argument that the engineers at Google who create these apps, let's say Google News, which aggregates 25,000 newspapers and magazines from around the world, and is free, and you can click on it and read and link to newspapers or magazines, is that content or is that aggregation? If it occupies your time, it's content, I would argue. If you're on Facebook for 2 hours, that's 2 hours you're not spent reading. You're not spending reading a book.
But my point is,
YouTube, same thing.
Yep. But my point is that Google is not creating that content. They're facilitating a way for us to get to all sorts of content that's available there. But does that make them a media company, or are they just a cool software company?
Well, I think they're both. Click on YouTube, you're watching video.
Yeah.
Is that media? Of course it is.
Right.
If you Google books and you read a book, is that media? Of course it is. And you know, but then your larger point, and I think it's an important one, is what do you do about the content creators who are not getting, they feel, paid money for the content that is helping Google make money? And that's a basic issue. So what happened? When the book publishers sued Google for taking their books and saying you have to compensate, Google came forth and said, we'll pay $125 million. When Google went into negotiations with Viacom over YouTube, Google had agreed to pay Viacom some money, just not as much as Viacom wanted. So Google now is accepting the principle they'll pay some compensation. And I think you're in a, I think in part what you're watching with Mr. Murdoch is the opening battle or the opening stages in the negotiation.
You mentioned Google's effort to digitize books. Where are they in that right now? How far have they progressed?
They've progressed pretty far. I mean, the judge last week approved the settlement that Google had reached with the Authors Guild and with the publishers. And he said that the Justice Department, he would like them to weigh in with their take, their opinion, by February as to whether they, too, would approve the settlement. But the judges basically said, I agree with the settlement as now reached, as now amended by Google and the parties.
So they can go forward and start digitizing even more books?
If the Justice Department, after the Justice Department, weighs in February.
Gotcha.
They've already digitized 10 million books. So it's
wow.
Not like they
wow.
Kind of, which is half of all the books allegedly ever published.
Wow. Let's talk about search, which is, you know, at the heart of it. That's Google's core business there. There once was a company called AltaVista, which was king of the world of search, and then Yahoo came along and kind of kicked them off of the top of the hill, and then Google came along and did that to Yahoo. Who's going to try to do that to Google now?
Well, I think one of the things that Google worries about is that, you know, you do a search and you get back thousands of answers. Now, it's a pretty remarkable thing, Google search. There's no ads on the homepage. You get a response within an average of 0.4 seconds, and it's pretty cool. On the other hand, that's a lot of search results to wade through. I mean, I did a search, who's the real William Shakespeare? And, of course, there's a historical debate, was Shakespeare really Shakespeare? I got back 5 million search results. That's ridiculous. So what Google worries about is a more efficient search engine, what's called a vertical search. And one of those looming out there is a real danger to them are social networks. And by that I mean either Facebook or Twitter. If I can go to my friends, I'm about to buy a camera, and I post something and I say, have any of you had any experience with the Samsung or the Sony or whatever the camera is, give me a reading on it. And I get back 20 responses from people I know, recommendations. That may be a more valuable search to me than getting 10,000 responses from a Google search.
Hmm.
And that's why, one of the reasons why Google tried last spring to buy Twitter.
And why didn't Twitter sell?
They don't want to sell. They think they're going to have a giant company. They make no money now, by the way. They have a big audience, but they make no money. But their model is Google. Google went for 3.5 years, starting in 1998, without making any money.
Mm-hmm. But then Google came upon the concept of AdWords and then AdSense, as you write about in the book. And they are, of course, making tons of money. Was it 99% of their income comes from ads now, Ken?
Just about 99%. They make a little over 20. Their total revenue is $22 billion. Of that, about a little over 21 is advertising. By the way, to tell you how large that is equal to all the consumer advertising in all the magazines in the United States.
Wow. Wow.
And that's those little boxes on the right-hand side, those gray boxes, little two- or three-line ads. That's where they generate that kind of money.
Google actually tried to get into the print ad business, didn't they?
And failed. And they tried to get in the radio business, advertising business, and failed. They shuttered both of them. They're still in the TV advertising business trying to sell advertising. Google is always going to be pushing the envelope because one of the things I found in spending a lot of time out there, the engineer... And the engineer is king at a place like Google. The engineer is sitting there, and they're asking a basic question, and that question is why. So when they look at advertising, they say, why? Why does a company that advertises have to spend millions of dollars on ads, $3 million for a single spot on the Super Bowl for 30 seconds, and not know who watches or who buys because of that ad? What if you could actually only charge the advertiser when they click on an ad? Which, by the way, is exactly the Google model today.
Mm-hmm.
That's a much more efficient system. And instead of charging them 4 or 5% to buy the ad, what if we charge them only 1%? And when you start asking those why questions, you disrupt a lot of businesses.
Talking with Ken Auletta, his book is called Googled, The End of the World as We Know It, here on News Talk 97.3, Cairo FM. Our friends over in Redmond, just a short hop from us here in Seattle, are saying, hey, you talked about their rivals, but you didn't talk about Microsoft. Google and Microsoft, tell me about that rivalry.
Oh, it's a huge rivalry. I mean, one of the things that happened at at Google. Google was formed in a garage in 1998. In fact, in 1998, I was doing a book on Microsoft, and I was interviewing Bill Gates. And I said, Mr. Gates, what do you worry about when you think about the future? And I thought he would say Netscape or Apple or some other company. Instead, what he did, he said, I worry about someone in the garage who will invent some new technology I've never thought about. Well, the new technology was Google. But what happened with Google, they kept a very low profile. They didn't go public until 2004 when they hired a longtime Microsoft adversary by the name of Eric Schmidt as their CEO in 2001. One of his pieces of advice to them was, don't moon the giant. Don't do what Netscape did and make it like it's a battle between Google and Microsoft. So Google stayed under Microsoft's radar. And by the time they surfaced, they were a real powerhouse. And now they are the biggest threat that Microsoft has ever faced. But if you think for a moment that Google is sitting there not worrying about Microsoft and its deep pockets and discussions with Rupert Murdoch today, you got another thing coming. Of course they are. Microsoft is a powerful, successful company. But having been there about 10 days ago, they're also a company that is very feeling like, you know, Google is the new star in town.
But they would never admit that Google has passed them, would they?
Well, they know Google has passed them in search. I mean, the results are clear. I mean, Google has two-thirds of the market share in search, and Microsoft has under 20%.
Mm-hmm. And what about the rivalry between Google and Apple? I'm guessing from reading in your book that that Larry Page and Sergey Brin and even Eric Schmidt, they have a different relationship with Steve Jobs than they do with Bill Gates.
Yes, they deeply admire Steve Jobs. I mean, don't forget, they come out of the Valley, these people. And in the Valley, Microsoft was thought to be the evil empire, the closed shop that was trying to create an operating system and rule the world. So there's a natural tendency upon a lot of people who grew up in the Valley, as Sergey Brin and Larry Page and Eric Schmidt did, and Steve Jobs did, to have a certain disdain or contempt or wariness of Microsoft. But what's happened is that even though they have been closely allied with Apple, and in fact both Brin and Page said to me the person they most admire is Steve Jobs. Nevertheless, in the nature of business today, you both compete and cooperate with people. So for years they cooperated with Apple and they didn't bump into each other. But now they're both in the phone business. So they're bumping into each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates strain. So Eric Schmidt, who was on the Apple board, was compelled this summer to resign.
Because of that direct rivalry.
Yeah. I mean, they're in conflict certainly on phones. They're going to be in conflict on other things as well.
I want to talk to you.
So is another neighbor of yours. I mean, Jeff Bezos, one of the things I report in my book is that he was a secret early investor, one of four initial investors in Google, and loved them. Loved Larry. He told me, loved Larry Page and Sergey Brin and their passion. Well, you know, and they never bumped into each other, but now Google is going to be selling books.
Oh, they are?
You bet. I mean, part of the deal on electronic books is any book that's a so-called orphan book, where they don't know who the copyright owner is, the author or publisher, who's the copyright owner, Google has permission to sell those books electronically.
Mm. Well, I can see where Amazon is looking over their shoulder at them and wondering what they're going to do about these guys who, from nowhere a decade ago to everywhere today. Let me take a break, and then we'll come back. And I want to talk to you a little bit about the culture of Google, and particularly about Larry and Sergey, these two guys who seem so much like oil and water to me. Ken Auletta's book is called Google, The End of the World as We Know It. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.
Hey, coming up at 3:05 on the Ron and Don Show, how come some climatologists are calling for a climate change timeout? We'll tell you this afternoon. It's Ron and Don on 97.3 FM.
I'm Paul Harris, filling in for Dave Ross. I'm talking with Ken Auletta, who's been covering media for a long, long time. He's written the Annals of Communications column for the New Yorker magazine since 1992. Written some terrific books, including a book that I read through twice. It was so compelling, called Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way. And he has always been trying to keep up with the constantly morphing world of media, which led him to his newest book, Googled, The End of the World as We Know It. In the book, Ken, you talk about the guys who started it in a garage, as you say, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who are like oil and water. How has their friendship, let alone their business partnership, lasted long enough to turn themselves into billionaires?
They're just great friends. I mean, they share an office and always have. They just connect. They talk all the time. Sergey gets married. Larry gets married a little later. Sergey has a child earlier this year. Larry just became a dad. They're just very close. Same age, same interest, same brilliance. In the 2.5 years I spent reporting this book, I never caught a hint of friction between them. Sergey tends to be more voluble and more of a ham, more of a showman than Larry. And so at the weekly TGIFs on Friday afternoon, Sergey will often do most of the talking. But as I would watch Larry stand behind him, Larry was laughing at every one of Sergey's jokes. You never had a sense that he recoiled that Sergey was getting more attention or was hogging the stage. I mean, they just have a good relationship.
As you talk about them in the book and the culture that they've developed there, the famous Google culture with, you know, the cafeterias and the dry cleaners and all the other stuff that's on that campus, and the fact that their employees can spend time working on their own individual products or projects. I'm curious about whether that campus has been affected by the recession at all.
Well, it has, but less so than most other companies in this world. I mean, what they did, Google was a company that didn't make any choices. And then the recession hits in late 07, early 08, and suddenly Google is forced to make choices. So instead of 150 snacks, they cut it down by, you know, to two-thirds. They still have, 40-some-odd snacks, but you don't have as many.
Uh-huh.
And they closed the Phoenix office, and they closed a couple of sites. So Google began to grow up and make some choices, inevitably. And in fact, they were not a well rigorously managed company, and they're more rigorously managed today. And so, in that sense, it was probably a benefit that the recession helped in terms of improving Google's efficiency. But nevertheless, they're still growing. A lot of companies have gone into loss situations. Their growth has become negative. Google still has a positive growth trajectory.
Where are they still playing catch-up, Ken?
Well, they're playing catch-up in other things. I mean, they have one, as Steve Ballmer often says, they're a one-trick pony. Eric Schmidt comes back, the CEO, and says it's a pretty good trick. And, of course, it is a very good trick. It makes a lot of money. But that growth is slowing in Google Search. So the question is, can Google find other ways to make money, as Microsoft did, you know, with Outlook? And Google is betting on three horses or ponies here. One is YouTube, where they still are losing money, but they've reduced the losses. Two is what they're doing in cell phones with the Android operating system, which is a potential moneymaker, but they haven't figured out how to make money on it yet. And the third is so-called cloud computing, which is, instead of buying Microsoft software packages, let us give it to you more cheaply in the cloud. And those are the three bets that Google is making. But so far, Google has one major engine of growth and profitability, and that's search. And they need others.
Yep. Well, you know, giving away stuff like Blogger and Picasa and Google Voice are great ideas for consumers like me. I certainly love getting those for free, but I wonder how, in the long run, they fit into the plan. I'm sure that they'll figure out a way eventually. The book is called...
They did. If you look at the history, Google, they figured out you build it and people will come and then we'll figure out a way to make money. And they did, and that's what Twitter's trying and Facebook is trying. Whether any of these companies succeed at that the way Google once did, and whether Google succeeds is a question.
Yep, an open question. Googled, the end of the world as we know it, the new book from Ken Auletta. Thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Dave Ross Show on News Talk 97.3 Cairo FM.